Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a trip back, way back to the very beginnings of software engineering.
Yeah, we've got this fascinating report from a 1968 NATO conference. The whole thing was just about software engineering.
And get this, the version we have, it's been scanned and OCR'd, you know, turned into text, which means you get some, let's say, interesting spelling choices sometimes. Adds a bit of historical flavor, maybe.
Definitely gives it character.
Yeah.
But yeah, our mission today is really to understand what those foundational challenges were and, well, what solutions they were thinking about over 50 years ago.
And you have to remember, this was totally pre-internet. I mean, a completely different world for anyone trying to build software back then.
Absolutely. A different universe, almost.
So the big question is, what were the main problems? What did they even mean by software engineering?
Well, the report jumps right in, doesn't it? It talks about what some people were already calling the software crisis of the late 1960s.
Yeah, sounds a bit dramatic, doesn't it? A crisis.
Well, maybe to us now. But, you know, think about it. These were often huge projects, government money involved, massive expectation.
Right. Failure wasn't just about missing a deadline.
Exactly. Right. The consequences could be pretty significant. So while crisis might seem like a strong word, it reflected a real worry.
Yeah.
A big gap opening up between what software promised and what it could actually, you know, deliver.
Mm.
It wasn't just late projects. It pointed to, well, a lack of mature methods, maybe. Overpromising based on the tech they had. We still kind of see that today with new tech sometimes,
right? Yeah. That pattern definitely sounds familiar. And almost straight away, problems pop up that honestly sound like they could be from last week's meeting.
Like what?
Budget blowouts, promises not being met, big worries about reliability, especially for like critical stuff. Air traffic control is mentioned.
Right.
It's almost a bit spooky how relevant those exact issues still are in software delivery today.
It is striking. And what's interesting is even back then, not everyone at the conference was shouting crisis. Now, some pointed to systems like OS 360. They were actually working pretty well for what users needed at the time.
Ah, okay.
So there was this debate, was it really a crisis or was it just, you know, a set of incredibly difficult challenges they needed to figure out?
Got it. So if they were facing these big challenges, what did they think was causing them? What were the root issues?
Well, one thing they identified was this kind of blurry line between software built just for research and software meant for, you know, everyday practical use.
Ah, the lab versus the real world.
Pretty much.
Mm.
There was maybe a tendency to chase the exciting, brand new, fancy systems instead of doing the, let's face it, sometimes less glamorous work of making existing systems stable and better.
Right, the shiny new toy syndrome. We still fight that battle between innovation and keeping the core reliable, don't we?
We absolutely do. It's an ongoing tension.
Okay, so that's one cause. What about how they actually approached designing software back then? What did design even look like?
Well, even in 68, they knew it wasn't just straight line. They saw design as iterative.
Iterative, even then.
Yeah. They described this cycle. You draw some flowcharts, you write some code.
Okay.
And then you almost always realized, wait, I didn't fully understand the problem at the start.
Huh. Sounds familiar.
So you revise, you recode, and that cycle, well, it feeds right into those deadline pressures we still wrestle with today, dealing with scope creep and changing requirements.
More things change. Yeah. Okay, so iteration was understood. What other sort of basic building blocks did they identify as really important early on?
Oh, specifications and interfaces were huge. They knew how critical clear documentation was.
Documentation.
Yeah, outlining exactly how the hardware and software talk to each other and also defining how different bits of software connect.
Right.
Think about trying to build a car if you didn't have a manual for the engine. That's kind of the chaos they were trying to head off.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good analogy. Makes sense. And as software got more complex, which it obviously did, how did they think about managing that complexity?
The idea of top-down design started to emerge. Basically, breaking big, complicated systems into smaller, more manageable pieces.
Divide and conquer.
Exactly. The classic approach we still use. But the tools they had back then, mainly flowcharts.
Right. You mentioned flowcharts.
Yeah. And while they're okay for simple stuff, they really struggled to show the kind of layered hierarchical structure of the bigger systems that were starting to be built.
So the core concept was there, but the tools hadn't quite caught up yet.
Pretty much. Classic story in tech, isn't it?
It really is. Now, you also mentioned their actual understanding of what software was changing. How so?
Yeah, there was this shift happening. They started moving away from seeing a program as just like a list of instructions, almost like a recipe you follow step by step, towards seeing software more as a way to transform data, to create relationships between bits of information. Data itself started becoming much more central to their thinking.
That feels like a pretty fundamental shift in perspective. And I know there was one figure, Dijkstra, who had some pretty, well, revolutionary ideas.
Oh, yes. Edgar Dijkstra. His ideas about hierarchical ordering using these layered structures, incredibly advanced for the time. Maybe not totally practical with the tech they had, but visionary.
What was the core idea?
His vision was essentially to use really rigorous design principles, almost mathematical precision, to potentially prove that software was correct.
Prove it. So, like, no need for testing.
That was the really ambitious goal, eliminate traditional testing altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But the catch was applying that level of formal proof right at the start during the problem solving and requirements phase.
Ah, making sure you were proving the right thing was correct.
Exactly. Making sure you were even solving the right problem perfectly. That was the tricky part.
Okay, so mathematically perfect code was maybe a bit far off then. What were their more down-to-earth thoughts on making sure software actually worked?
They were very interested in simulation as a testing method.
Simulation?
Yeah, the report makes this cool comparison to the Wright brothers using wind tunnels and models.
Oh, interesting.
Testing their designs thoroughly before trying to actually fly. They clearly saw the value-saving cost, improving safety by catching problems early through simulation.
That makes a ton of sense. Find the problems in a safe space first. That sounds a lot like the shift left testing ideas we talk about in DevOps now, finding issues earlier.
It really does align strongly with that modern practice, yes. Proactive testing.
Okay, simulation helps. But what about measuring progress? We know that's notoriously hard in software. What'd they think?
Yeah, they totally recognized how hard it is to measure software progress compared to, say, manufacturing widgets.
Right.
And they were smart enough to see that simple metrics like just counting lines of code or how many bugs got fixed
mm-hmm.
could actually backfire. They could push developers towards behaviors you didn't really want, like quantity over quality.
That sounds exactly like the conversations we have in the DevOps world about metrics. You know, avoiding vanity metrics and focusing on value stream measures instead.
Precisely. The danger of metrics driving the wrong behavior was understood even then.
Wow. Okay, what about the eternal problem? Estimating how long a project will take.
Oh, yeah, they tackled that one, too. They basically admitted that estimation is fundamentally uncertain.
Refreshing honesty.
Right. They said, look, even if you have teams with the same skills working on what looks like the same project, the time it takes will probably still vary a lot.
So what was their advice? Just guess.
Huh. Not quite. Their advice was pretty practical. Start with optimistic estimates, sure, but be ready to constantly adjust them as you learn more during the project.
That sounds remarkably like agile thinking, doesn't it? Iterative development and adapting based on feedback.
It resonates very strongly with that, yes.
Mm.
Continuous refinement based on learning. Still solid advice today.
Definitely. Now, this next part really caught my eye, especially thinking about modern DevOps. The idea that the team structure affects the software architecture.
Ah, yes. That's a fascinating insight from the report. It hints at this mirroring effect.
Mirroring?
Yeah, the way you organize your development team can actually shape the software they build. For instance, they suggested that if you have more modular, independent teams, they might naturally create software that's also more modular and loosely coupled.
That's basically Conway's Law, isn't it? Or at least a precursor to it. That idea that system design mirrors the organization's communication structure.
Exactly. It's an incredibly early observation of what Mel Conway later formalized. And it's absolutely central to modern DevOps, thinking about team topologies, autonomy, and how that enables things like microservices.
A really powerful connection between the social and the technical. Okay, what other challenges started popping up as software became more critical?
Well, they started seeing the rise of these big, always-on systems. Think early airline reservations or banking systems.
Right, systems that couldn't just be switched off easily.
Precisely. And that brought new problems, particularly around updates. How do you change or fluke something in a system that needs to run continuously without disrupting the service?
Especially with the deployment tools they had back then, which must have been pretty basic.
Extremely basic compared to now. So this challenge of updating live critical systems without interruption was a major hurdle.
That struggle really foreshadows why things like zero downtime deployments and robust rollback strategies are so crucial in modern DevOps and SRE.
Absolutely. The pain was felt very early on. planned downtime for major systems just isn't acceptable anymore.
For sure. So they saw these challenges. How did they think about making the whole development process more efficient?
Automation. There was a growing understanding that they needed automation to improve efficiency.
What kind of automation?
They mentioned specific things like better file systems, tools to help with compilation, automated test systems, diagnostic tools.
Okay, the nuts and bolts.
Yeah. And there was this philosophy mentioned from someone named Beamer, I think. Start small. Build useful tools that provide value now.
Small, useful now. I like that. That sounds very agile, very DevOps iterative improvement, focusing on automating the pipeline piece by piece.
It aligns perfectly. That focus on practical incremental automation is still a hallmark of high-performing teams.
And it sounds like they were also starting to think about not reinventing the wheel every time, reusing work.
Definitely. The idea of reusable software components came up.
Components. Like libraries today.
Sort of the conceptual ancestor, yeah. Using pre-built pieces to speed things up and make fewer errors.
That's fundamental to how we build software now, with libraries, frameworks, microservices, all about reuse.
It really laid the groundwork. Recognizing the power of building blocks was a key insight, totally relevant to accelerating delivery in DevOps today.
So efficiency, reuse. What about the actual users, the people interacting with the software?
They talked quite a bit about managing user expectations and the quality of the service.
How?
Emphasizing setting realistic goals, making sure the first release was stable.
Prioritizing stability.
Okay. And also this interesting idea of shared responsibility.
Oh.
Both developers and users had a role in accepting that early software might have bugs.
Hmm. Interesting balance.
And they seemed to prefer fewer releases that were more thoroughly tested, rather than a constant stream of potentially buggy updates. A focus on reliability and user satisfaction.
That focus on stability and user trust is still paramount. Even with faster release cycles now, it's a balancing act.
It always is.
And thinking about changes over time, did they foresee issues like compatibility problems?
They did. They showed some early awareness that keeping different versions of software compatible would be a challenge.
Anyone who's fought dependency hell knows that pain.
Exactly. It's a problem that has definitely persisted, even with all our modern tools like version control and CI/CD.
Absolutely. Okay, another often unloved but vital area. Documentation. What did they say about that?
They saw it as absolutely crucial, not just nice to have, but essential for saving costs and preventing total chaos in the long run.
Especially as things grew more complex.
Right. With more programming languages, bigger systems,
mm-hmm.
good documentation was key. They even talked about tailoring it for different audiences, like users versus other developers.
Sure.
And they were even thinking about automating parts of the documentation process back then.
Wow. That's forward thinking. And high-quality docs are still so important for maintainability, understanding systems. It directly impacts things like team speed and cognitive load, which DOR research tracks.
Absolutely. It's a direct enabler of better, faster delivery.
Okay, so the field is emerging. How did they think about teaching people to do this work? Software engineering education.
Ah, well, that sparked some fundamental debates.
Yeah.
Like how much formal university education do you need versus just learning on the job?
The classic theory versus practice debate.
Exactly. There were worries that the early computer science programs were too theoretical, maybe not preparing students for the actual messiness of building real-world software.
Mm.
So there were calls for more practical training, finding a better balance. It's a conversation that, frankly, still goes on in CS education today.
It really does seem like a perennial balancing act. Now, you mentioned one topic that sounded potentially controversial, something about pricing.
Yes, the unbundling debate. Should software be priced and sold separately from the hardware it ran on?
Ah, okay. What were the arguments?
Well, separating them could lead to more transparency in the market, maybe help independent software companies grow.
Makes sense.
But the counterargument was, well, could this stifle innovation in hardware? And would it maybe hurt smallest software companies who relied on those bundles?
Right. So they were already grappling with software becoming its own distinct product, its own industry.
Precisely. The very definition of software as a commercial entity was being debated.
It's just fascinating how many seeds of our current industry discussions were sown way back in 1968. So let's try and wrap this up. What's the big takeaway from looking at this old report, especially through our modern lens of building and delivering software?
I think the biggest thing is just how relevant so much of it still is. It's actually quite startling.
Yeah.
Managing complexity, hitting deadlines, ensuring quality, figuring out user needs, these core challenges they identified. They are absolutely central to software engineering today, and they're exactly the kinds of things modern approaches like DevOps and research like DORA are trying to get better at managing and measuring.
So understanding this history gives us perspective.
Huge perspective. It shows us we're part of this long, ongoing effort to solve these really hard problems. It's not like these challenges are brand new.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder that while the tech stack changes like crazy, those fundamental human and organizational problems in creating software, they stick around.
They really do.
Makes you appreciate the folks back then grappling with this stuff right at the beginning. Real pioneers.
Definitely. They really did lay the groundwork for so much of what we aim for now. Speed, stability, reliability, and how we deliver software.
Well, this has been a really illuminating deep dive, looking back at a key chapter in what we're calling our software delivery notebook. We hope you found this trip through software history useful, maybe gained some perspective on the challenges we still face today.
Thanks for joining us on this exploration.
Until our next deep dive.